Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I would have liked to know you, but I was just a kid. Your candle burned out long before. Your legend never will.
It is Monday, which means it's time for the Front Three Weekend Review with me, Adam Boltwood, the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Good to have you.
And the man, the myth, the legend that is Chris Henich.
Nice to be here.
Oh, nice to have you here. There's so much to talk about from this weekend, guys. We're going to be reviewing the Premier League action, including Liverpool's draw with Chelsea, Spurs dropping more points at home against West Brom, and Newcastle being hammered at St. James's Park by Watford. We're also going to be talking to Serie A correspondent from The Sportsman, Chloe Beresford, about AC Milan, who have sacked their manager Vincenzo Montella and hired club legend Gennaro Gattuso. What could possibly go wrong there? And finally, in part three, we'll be discussing some of the other big moments from around Europe this weekend, including Lionel Messi's ghost goal from this weekend that denied Barcelona victory against Valencia. We'll also be talking Borussia Dortmund's capitulation, surrendering a four-goal lead half-time to Schalke to draw 4-4, and what that means for manager Peter Bosch. And finally, Patrick Kluivert's son. Turns out he's quite good at football. We'll talk about that later on. But first,
and of
Lawrence,
course, Gary Megson. Megson. Must be Megson.
And we'll be talking about Megson and banter and all that good stuff. But we've got to start, Lawrence, with Liverpool. The big game this weekend. They welcomed Chelsea to Anfield. 1-1 in the end. Was that a fair result, do you think, on the balance of play?
I think Chelsea and Liverpool didn't create enough clear-cut chances for either team to really feel like they dominated the game. Conte, in the post-match, was saying how he thought that Chelsea could have won it. That's possible. I think Liverpool can look very open. But I think maybe to the coaches who are looking, they know exactly what their tactic is. And Conte will have known what areas he wanted Chelsea to get into. I think he will have identified that they could have scored more against Liverpool. But at the same time, I think Liverpool could also have put more of their chances away. So 1-0 is probably fair. I think overall, in terms of play, Chelsea looked much more cohesive as a side. I think they look much more defined in terms of roles. And you especially see this when Liverpool play. The teams who look incredibly well-drilled, disciplined, and also have very well-defined roles. Whereas it seems a lot more like Klopp is able to maybe let Salah, Mane, or if Mane was playing the full amount of time, and the likes of Sturridge to roam, which at times leaves too much space and the ball will go errant or it's not quite right. So I think Liverpool can be just as upset for not winning the game, because especially the way that they conceded the goal. I mean, to watch a ball sail over Simon Mignolet,
yeah,
after it was supposed to be a cross.
It's definitely a cross, wasn't it? There's no way he was. I mean, William.
Yeah, he looked surprised.
Yeah, as we all did.
Yeah.
It's interesting what Lawrence is saying there, Chris. I mean, Chelsea, they seem to be setting up in this 3-5-1-1 formation, especially in the big games away from home. Obviously, defensively solid, but didn't really trouble Liverpool as it did West Brom the previous week in the Premier League. Do you think maybe, just as we criticise Mourinho for perhaps not being aggressive enough in attacking Liverpool's frailties, do you think you could level the same accusation at Conte in this game?
No, I thought from what I saw the game, I thought it just moved at such a frenetic pace that it was hard to generate any real rhythm. I think to go to Liverpool in the first place, I don't know if the onus is on you to try and win the game. I think that for that reason, a draw is a fairly decent-ish result when you consider how they played as well. I don't think they intended to go and draw the game. I think they wanted to try and suck Liverpool in, which is a sizable difference to what others have done. I just think when you looked at the speed of Liverpool and the speed of Chelsea alongside it, to me it seemed like it was just too difficult to even generate anything that felt even remotely intricate.
I think it's also fair to say, though, that obviously Hazard was fouled out of the game. I don't think that Conte's solution came fast enough to change that, because he knew that he would be fouled out of the game, but it didn't seem like Morata wasn't able during this game, foil, if you like, for Hazard. I don't think he had quite enough support from what he needed. They looked very solid defensively, like Chris said. They definitely played differently to the way that Manchester United chose to approach Liverpool earlier on in the season. But it felt like a lot of it went through Hazard, which was great when it came off. But too often, it's a bit like almost like playing Juventus when they tried to go through Hazard, because he was never allowed to get close enough to do any real damage. He was just allowed to wander around in the areas that Liverpool sort of felt comfortable with him being. So it was frustrating to watch as well, because you knew that Chelsea had Willian and those guys on the bench who, as soon as they came on, I was much more worried for Liverpool and whether they would be able to hang on. And ultimately, they couldn't, even if it was a mistake or not. Can we also say Salah's really good? And
Salah's, yes.
Some people are also saying his lack of a celebration was because it was Chelsea. It was actually because of the tragedy in Egypt. So
there's definitely an issue, though, with Liverpool's ability to defend a lead. I think that more than anything is holding them back from any like notable success.
There's very little confidence in the side at the moment that when they do get a lead, then they'll be able to keep it. And that nervousness feeds into, it's almost self-fulfilling, if you like. In the same way that Klopp's self-fulfilling prophecy of positivity comes true, fans have taken that, and that same blueprint has been used for negativity. And so the believers that Klopp once had, to use his own cliche against him, believe a little bit less right now, because they don't believe they have anything to believe in. If you can believe that believe is that believable in so many believable words.
It's like a Russian doll of believing that. Should we talk about the mighty Tottenham Hotspur, who dropped points at home once again at Wembley to West Brom this time? Gary Megson's West Brom. I actually took Nico to go and see this game. I was talking to him about how, you know, it was going to be a 2-0, 3-0 win. It was just a game Spurs needed to get back on form.
So
in the
arrogant.
League. Didn't really work out that way. Walked in to the stadium as Salman Rondon was scoring that opener.
Did it go like you did? Were you like, yeah, we don't even need to turn up on time. This one's an easy three.
It's fine. I sort of underestimated the time it would take to get to the stadium with Nico, who was obviously visiting London this week. He's got like a little walking stick, hasn't he? Because he did his ACL that he did?
ACL, yeah.
Yeah, so the walking stick, I didn't really compensate for that in the time it takes to walk from Wembley Park tube station to the actual stadium itself. So we missed essentially the first goal, heard a cheer and assumed Spurs had scored. But no, it was actually West Brom.
But was like, yes, can't believe, oh, for fuck's sake.
Which of course was the worst possible thing, because, you know, Spurs have struggled this season to break down teams who come and sit deep. Spurs would be expected to be at home at least, like Burnley, who are obviously playing very well this season, Swansea as well. And it's something that, you know, there was a lot made last week about how Spurs have failed to pick up points away against the top six. Where Spurs pick up the majority of their points, especially last season, where we didn't lose a single game at home, is in those home games. That's where we can't afford to drop any points. Already this season, we've dropped more points at home than we did in the entirety of last season.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know,
that was true after the third home game we played. But after this weekend, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that, you know, it is going to be a real tight race for that fourth spot. There's only 3 points separating Chelsea in third and Liverpool in sixth now. I think it's going to come down to Arsenal, Spurs, Liverpool all chasing for that last spot. And this is where Spurs need to be picking up points. I think, you know, we've started slowly in every game at home in these games where it's been very frustrating against opposition that sits deep. There seems to be this lack of tempo, this lack of creativity that makes it difficult to break them down. but it's difficult to see how Spurs solve this issue. I mean, it was made even harder on Saturday against West Brom when they scored in the fourth minute, I think. You know, they sat back after that. The Ben Foster seemed to be wasting time from the 10th minute onwards. But, I mean, the question is, how do you think Mauricio Pochettino solves this problem, Chris? I mean, it seems at the moment we're missing Toby Alderweireld, who went off against Real Madrid in the Champions League for injury. Looks like he might not be back until January now. I don't think it's any coincidence that in the last four league games, Spurs have only taken a possible 4 points from 12 available. They do seem to be missing him, not only missing the defensive solidity, considering we've conceded in all four of our last four games when we'd conceded zero in the four games preceding that, but also the creativity, the bringing the ball out from the back, that element that you give Spurs.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right to point to Alderweireld as well. I think he's hugely influential in terms of starting attacks and being able to pass through the lines. How you solve that is difficult because I don't know if there's a ready-made replacement. And the problem you have when you have a back three is it does use a lot of your centre-back options in your squad. I don't think it's that realistic to have six or seven, you know, first-choice centre-backs. You look at the fact that Cameron Carter-Vickers has been loaned out for the season, more than likely because I think it was aware that he wouldn't get first-team opportunities. I mean, he's playing in a back three at Sheffield United, which seems a good idea in terms of preparing him. But I think in terms of a change, I have to confess, there's nothing that really jumps out to me as obvious to do. A back four would really nullify the influence of fullbacks realistically. It might give them a little bit more structure, perhaps. But I think, yeah, the key thing for me is I do feel like they miss that influencer in the final third. I don't necessarily think this is something that's wrong with the defence. I think it's something where I look at, say, Richarlison, for example, and I can't help but feel a player like him who's willing to be direct, who's willing to be aggressive, could really be an influence for Spurs. Because I like Son. I think he has that running in him, but I think he's better on the counter-attack, whereas if you've got a fullback standing you up, Richarlison's willing to go at him. I don't know if Son and the members of that squad really are, bar Eric Lamella, who at this precise moment is no more guaranteed than the snow at Christmas.
He's supposed to be back in contention, Eric Lamella, for the game at Leicester on Tuesday night, but we'll see about that.
As long as he's good in training.
Yeah. Pochettino did come out after the game. He seemed keen to point out that Spurs have got the same number of points as last season at this stage, while obviously they
and topped. We didn't win last season either.
Yeah, but I just think that, as I said, I feel like it's becoming clear that it's going to be a race for the top four spot for Spurs, and we can't really afford to drop these points at home, at Wembley, I should say.
Adam, do you think? I mean, it's clear that they're not quite as powerful as they want to be. I think. They want to, you know, the description that we gave them in the documentary and the kind of football they wanted was to be a bit more, maybe a bit more controlling against a team like West Brom, and able to move West Brom around a little bit better. And I think that's where maybe, like Chris is saying, a player like Son doesn't quite do that.
Yeah, it was strange. Son was probably Spurs' best attacking outlet in that first half. He seemed to get a lot of space down the left-hand side when it switched to this four at the back and Son was pushed out wide on the left as opposed to sort of a central position. He did seem more threatening there, but there have been these questions over Pochettino's team selection at home. I'm not 100% sure I agree with them, but you know, there's obviously the situation going on with Danny Rose at the moment. He was completely left out of the squad for Saturday's game. Serge Aurier as well, who's left on the bench. You know, his performances this season have either been incredibly impressive or questionable, but a lot of people wanted to see him start over Kieran Trippier just to give that extra dimension in the wing-back position. It's frustrating. I think there is this real lack of tempo when we're playing at home, and as you say, that ability to pass the ball with pace, to move West Brom around, to pull them out of position, we didn't really do enough on the ball to do that, to force those opportunities, to break them down. And in the end, West Brom could have won it towards the end of the game. As Spurs were sort of pushing forward, looking for that winner, West Brom had two great chances towards the end. So it is a worry, and I think it does sort of crystallise over the past few weeks, the form for Spurs, as I said, 4 points from a possible 12. They've lost two, drawn one, won just one game there. It does create those worries. And I know there was this sense that, the idea of the Wembley curse is gone. You know, it was all rubbish after we beat Liverpool. But I think the question is more complicated than that. Yes, we beat Liverpool, but because they played into Spurs' hands. I think when we're playing against these teams, even when we beat Palace, even when we beat Bournemouth at home, it was only by one solid goal, one single goal, I should say. So I think there are those issues there. And I think Pochettino needs to find the solutions sooner rather than later, because we've got Brighton and Stoke at home at Wembley before the year is out, which could cause questions as well. And, you know, we could drop more points in this race for the top four. But we'll see what happens. Leicester on Tuesday night.
Leicester Tuesday night, that's a good chance. But you need to pay your squad more than two frogs in a conker. This is what I'm really mystified by. Chris, you liked this post, and I hadn't seen it. Gary Megson has said some of the weirdest shit. He masterminded it, right? And it was very, very clever. I'll bring up the doc that I pasted it into. But he also keeps using the phrase two frogs and a conker, two dead frogs and a conker.
What does that mean?
Well, I think, Chris, it's in reference to payment. So there's a few contexts here, because he said some very weird shit in the past. So he says, maybe makes his post-match quip about bringing Kevin Cooper to Edgeley Park for two dead frogs and a conker had some feeling behind it. He then talks about, we were paying him two dead frogs and a conker. I'm not going to traipse around the country for two dead frogs and a conker each week. He's really obsessed with two dead frogs and a conker.
Wow. If anyone knows what that means, I think they should tweet us in, because I'm lost, if that makes sense.
It must be a Manchester thing. But then over the weekend, he said, I've enjoyed being amongst football people again. They call it banter these days. I don't know what that is.
Jeez.
Oh, good old Megson. Listen,
it's just such a great quote.
I don't
know what that is.
We've talked about Lawrence's team. We've talked about my team. Let's talk about your team, Chris. You might not.
Man United.
Yeah, you've changed them as of this week. Four defeats in a row for Newcastle United, Chris. I mean, obviously, a 3-0 defeat to Watford this weekend. Obviously, Marco Silva's done fantastic work at Watford. Obviously, he's burnished his reputation once again with this victory. But at the same time, what's going wrong for Rafael Benitez in Newcastle? Because just a few short weeks ago, there was a lot of optimism in the club. Mid-table position, I think, doing better than many people expected. That seems to have dissipated now, doesn't it?
I mean, that's the beauty of this podcast. It's a little bit like break time at school, where you all have nice Game Boys and PSPs, and I've got two dead frogs and a conga. in so much as, look, they didn't spend a lot of money in the summer in terms of the context of what they got rid of and how much they brought in from sales. And it's meant that the squad is actually quite shallow. It doesn't have a lot of options. And then a lot of its first choice options are championship players adjusting to the Premier League. But there are a lot of players who don't. And what I was saying to you before, Adam, before we started recording, was it's not necessarily that Rafa Benitez hasn't made bad transfer deals. That is a true statement. You look at Ashraf Lazar, is not the greatest. I don't think Javi Manquillo is that good either. But then you have to add in the fact that his margin for error is smaller than any other Premier League manager, because he hasn't got a lot of money. And it's easy to turn around at the same time and say, well, you know, that's just the way it is. That would be acceptable if that was the financial situation the club were in. They could spend more money. They have the means with which to do so, but the owner chooses not to do so. And I think that's where the frustration emanates from. Because if it was, to draw a comparison, like Sunderland, who, to be frank, just don't have any more money to spend, then you can almost accept that and say, well, you know what? This is the consequence for years worth of actions. But Newcastle really haven't spent a huge sum, contextually, obviously, in a transfer net spend for a long, long time under Ashley. And that's the problem, is that you come up against a team like Watford, who, again, I wouldn't say spent a huge sum either, but they didn't have huge outgoings, and they were able to pay good money for good players like Andre Gray, like Richarlison. It makes their job much easier. and it allows someone like Silva to have a balanced squad with a bit of depth to it. So on Saturday, he could bring on Etienne Capoue, Roberto Pereira, just two examples of the type of quality player that Newcastle don't have. And it means, furthermore, that it limits the options that, that Benitez has. He named a 4-4-2 at the weekend, but that, honestly, I think he got that really wrong, because Diame and Shelby weren't going to provide any kind of defensive cover. In fact, there was a real lacking of industry on the team as a whole, and that was quite disappointing, because that's not usually what you associate with Newcastle under Benitez. But the fact that he can only really go 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1, it makes it hard to be adaptable. Now, he can be stubborn, so I'm not letting him off with that one, that, you know, if he had more players, he would be a lot more pragmatic. But at the same time, you know, I just think they're in such a difficult position, because the strikers aren't good enough. None of their strikers have proved consistent in the top flight. The best midfielder from last season, Matt Ritchie, has never looked consistent in the Premier League yet. And so it paints them into a very narrow alleyway that, really, if we're sitting here January 1st and Newcastle have 25 to 30 points, I will be absolutely delighted. And I think that's where the fans' frustration emanates from, is that, again, this should be a lot easier than it is. Not because they're Newcastle or anything grandiosely stupid like that, but purely because they've got money, but he doesn't want to spend it. And it's another needless risk. I think that's what I should have just said to sum it up. It's another needless risk Mike Ashley's taken, and he didn't have to.
Obviously, there's them short-term worries you've spoken of, Chris, but perhaps in the long term, more worrying is the fact that the takeover deal for the club seems to have stalled. Have we heard anything about that? Have we got any updates?
Well, the thing is, if for anyone that's even, you know, come close to this kind of thing before, these things take time, and a lot of time, because you really do have to examine every nook and cranny, cross every T and dot every single I. And the best way to articulate that is, PCP and Amanda Staveley asked for 27 years worth of club accounts. And they will, as a financial institution, be incredibly diligent about the way that they go about this, which is stark comparison to Ashley, who didn't even check the books when he bought the place. At the same time, they want to get it for what they feel is a price that will maximize any potential profit they can make, or for, you know, for the least amount. It's a business at the end of the day. At the same time, Ashley wants to maximize his profit. And he's been known to be, for want of a better term, a bastard of a negotiator. He will happily walk away from the table if it's not what he wants. The problem is, I think actually he does want to sell. I think he wants out. I think he's a bit tired of this, and the stress and the difficulty and the constantly needing to work really hard for even just a little modicum of profit. And I think that plays into Staveley's hands a little bit. The good thing is, she's facilitated club purchases before, as I wrote for Yahoo this week. So I think it will get done, hopefully by Christmas, because January is a big month for them in terms of what they do. And I think if they could give Benitez 30, 40 million pounds, it will just allay a lot of fears. I think it'll take a while. But like I say, as I wrote for Yahoo, for me, I think this sale is less about a business transaction, and it's more an exorcism of the toxicity that's been allowed to proliferate under Mike Ashley.
Yeah, the Financial Times reporting that a second bid is expected, but any deal unlikely to happen before Christmas, so we'll see what happens there. We should talk about Everton, Lawrence. The shambles continues. They lost 4-1 to Southampton this week, following on from a 5-1 defeat to Atlanta in the week. So yeah, just the 9 goals conceded in 1 week for...
I'm just lighting some candles. Is that all right? Can you hear it okay?
Yeah, go for it, mate. You do what you got to do. But please still do talk to us about this situation. Obviously, the indecision and uncertainty over the new manager certainly hasn't done the club any favours. It's almost certain now that David Unsworth is David Dunsworth. And the reports today are that Big Sam, they're going to reopen talks with Big Sam, the Everton owners. A few weeks ago, we heard that Big Sam wasn't too impressed by the overtures that was made by Farhad Moshiri. He didn't feel wanted enough. But clearly, they're going to do whatever it takes now to get him back in, given that Everton are 2 points above the relegation zone. Is Big Sam or nothing?
Well, I mean, nothing is certainly an option. I mean, yeah, I see there's a real issue, Everton. There's a real issue, Everton. I think they thought that they were maybe a better prospect, or maybe they thought that it was quite toxic, maybe, in the dressing room. And so got rid of, obviously, Koeman. And then it's just sort of gotten worse since then. I think what I do find unusual about these situations, I don't know about anyone else out there, but the players, without any coaching, really don't seem to know what shape to play in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they seem clueless in many ways.
Yeah, but that's weird, isn't it? I mean, these are some experienced players out there who have, you know, even if you're in the under-18s.
Yeah, they should have a baseline of knowledge and tactical awareness.
You should have a baseline of roughly where you're meant to stand on the pitch. You know what I mean?
Seemingly not. The thing is, I can't help but feel this is pretty catastrophic mismanagement because, I mean, it's something we criticise clubs for a lot. Why sack a manager if you haven't got someone else lined up? I mean, say what you want about West Ham.
I will.
Bringing in David Moyes after sacking Slaven Bilic. But that's happened within the time frame that Everton sacked Ronald Koeman and have still let this whole situation drag on with David Unsworth, etc. West Ham made their move. Yes, you can criticise that move, but they made a decisive move. They got their manager in. He's had two games under his belt already. And Everton is still in this situation. It just seems a shambles.
Yeah, at least they know they're doomed. Do you know what I mean?
Whereas they may have made the wrong move, but they made a move, you know?
It's the hope that it'll kill you. No, I mean, obviously, we don't want to see Everton get relegated from the league. I think that would be a terrible thing for the Premier League as well, because Everton...
I believe they're the only club to never be relegated. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a fact. They won't be the only club... Yeah, no, it's definitely true. But they're not the only club not to be relegated, obviously, from the Premier League. There are loads of clubs that haven't been relegated from the Premier League. But as we know with Leeds, no club is too big to go down. The issue is this... I mean, there are miniature parallels, but not really. But there was, you know, Everton have got this new investment. There was fresh hope. There's all of the great things that you'd hope to see. They would allow them to compete with the top teams. And out of nowhere, I think a lot of people predicted this wouldn't go well. We've seen a lot of very silly decisions made in a short space of time. And no one seems to be putting the brakes on that, which I find really unusual.
Everton have never been relegated from the Premier League. We were right. One of seven teams never to be relegated. You know who else has never been relegated from the Premier League? Big Sam, Chris. Is Big Sam the man to save Everton?
Of the potential coaches suggested, I would say he's probably got a better chance than most. I know people sort of clamoured for Marco Silva, and I think Marco Silva is a very good coach. I don't know what he does with that team, though, that makes them have a sharp turnaround. And I say that because if you look at the Watford and Hull sides, there was a decent injection of pace put into them. He did it in the January window with Hull when he got the likes of Markovic in the ass. I guess you could say there's an irony in this fact he signed the ass. But the same with Watford. It's Richarlison, it's Firmino, it's people like that. And I think the thing with Big Sam is I watched when he was at Sunderland, he didn't actually have the greatest start with them either. His first 10 games weren't really a cascade of points and victories. So it does take a bit of time for his methods to settle in. But I look at that squad, you've got the likes of Ashley Williams, who for me is a kick-it-out defender. Michael Keane, who thrived in a Burnley side that, again, like to keep things basic. And you look at those principles Allardyce outlined on Sky about how to, quote-unquote, avoid relegation, things like not taking risks in your own half. Those are things I would say will mesh well with that squad. The concern you have, no matter who you hire, is they don't really have a recognised centre-forward. Wayne Rooney doesn't like to play that role. He doesn't really work very well in that role either. And I think one point that I saw made that was quite a good one was by Ped on Toffee TV, which was Romelu Lukaku not only dragged Everton's back line 10, 15 yards, it pushed the opposition's back 10, 15 yards. Whereas now, because there's no threat of pace in behind, teams are pushing up against Everton and squeezing the space a bit more because they don't feel as if there's a concern with that space in behind them. They've got some pace in there. Morales, Vasic, Lennon all have pace, but it's whether you can use that effectively, and I'm not sure how they do that right now, because at the minute, for me, watching Unsworth, it kind of seems like he's just jumping between formations. It was a 4-2-3-1 that doesn't really fit them. The back three, I wrote a piece on Medium again this week, and I could see why he picked the back three. It was to give them width, but it just didn't work. It looked just as disorganised as every other game he's taken charge of.
Yeah, don't change the formation when you can't even get the other one right, do you know? We haven't nailed this one. Let's try a back three.
That's the thing. It does just feel like he's lurching from idea to idea, but it's so pointless when the foundations aren't even there of someone like Ashley Williams being a vocal character or something like that. And you look at Phil Jagielka, bless him, 35 years old now. He looks every day of that 35 years old. And if you looked at the take-on map for Southampton, they just went down that right side every single time because they knew... Lennon is a right wing back, is not his favourite position, and Jagielka's got no real legs on him anymore.
That's a huge problem, I think, for those guys, is that, you see how important mentality and instilling that mentality is to a squad, because how quickly that's fallen apart is a stunt. It's amazing, really. Even this short run of games, it's possible to turn that around, obviously, because easy come, easy to go, I suppose. But it still must be very unusual to feel that way as a club. All that investment and go the other way.
And that was the problem with the summer window, and we talked about it at the time, is that, you can sign Sigurdsson and all this. The Sigurdsson deal in isolation looked bad. The Klaassen deal, again, in isolation looked bad, and I'm sure Walsh is getting a lot of pelters for it. But for all that money spent, they didn't think to take care of the issues or the aspects of the team and the squad that had fallen into disrepute. The fact that they only really had one or two fullback options. The fact that their centre-backs were incredibly agey. The fact that, again, they didn't have a striker to replace Romelu Lukaku. It's all issues that seemed so painfully obvious in the summer, but for some reason they didn't decide to sort at the time.
I think they thought maybe goals would come from another place. I think they thought the goals would come from the system. And it does seem, from a very rudimental standpoint, to hark more towards a Netherlands model or an Ajax-looking model from an English person's perspective, I think, because the emphasis was in a place where you could play the ball. But they didn't seem like a very balanced side. And I think everyone pointed that out in the summer.
Shall we finish up our Premier League talking points by mentioning Swansea, who drew 0-0 at home to Bournemouth? They stopped the rot, stopped a fifth successive defeat, but things looking pretty bleak for the Swans at the moment, Chris. They're currently just 1 point above bottom place with 9 for the season. Paul Clement under pressure. I mean, every team around him, the bottom five teams have sacked their manager apart from Swansea. How long do you think Clement's got in this job?
As my dad said at the weekend, Paul Clement looks like a car salesman, and that's not a good thing. To me, watching them, I just don't see what they're trying to do. I don't understand the idea. You look at, and I think it's best typified by Renato Sanchez, who for me is getting pelters every week. And it's that wonderful thing that Robbie Savage and Tim Sherwood have been thrown out about. If it was a Swansea youth team player, he'd never get back in the team. Great.
Brutal.
The problem people like Sanchez have is they come into this team and they don't really
that's
know.
That's such a stupid point, by the way. Such an amazingly stupid point.
If
Ronaldo has barely scored many this season, and he looked a little bit off it. Well, if he was a Swansea youth player, he wouldn't get back in the team. Well, no. Of course, we wouldn't have the expectation.
It's just an empty platitude. It's,
not from Robbie Savage.
Just, why not film it in black and white and read it off your phone? It'll be more interesting then.
Tune into BT next week.
It's just, the problem is Sanchez is not a terrible player. He really isn't. And I've been watching some of his Benfica games from way back when and seeing kind of what made him such an influential player. And it's the fact that he was carrying the ball, first and foremost, and using his athleticism. I don't see him being able to do that in this Swansea side. And again, it feels fitting that we go from Everton to Swansea, because they have a similar issue where their summer spending seemed incredibly lopsided and ignorant to previous issues. So they bring in Tammy Abraham, who, again, may become a fantastic forward, but has done nothing to prove himself in the Premier League. So if that goes south at any point, who are you relying on after that to get your goals? It's guys like McBurney and people that, again, have even less pedigree than Abraham does. And I think it for me, it feels like such a drastic departure from the Swansea that we know, who were planners, who were meticulous in their detail. And now I look at this coach who, again, when he came in, yep, they won games. You know, the January transfer window seemed to be ideal. And at this point, his record's pretty much rivaling Bob Bradley's. And Bradley was laughed out of the league as some kind of charlatan. So I think there needs to be a point where Swansea decide either, look, we go with someone else, or we actually install some kind of structure in this. And January 1st, we go after a striker we know will give them some options. Because even Boney, he's come back with no momentum behind him at all. And it's great to bring a player back that has a lot of good karma, if you will, with the supporters or whatever phrase you want to use. But he's not scored goals. And that's the concern I have, is that their strategy seems so disjointed, not just in transfers, but also tactically as well. And that's not something I thought we'd ever level at Paul Clement, because he seems quite adept in that aspect of the game. Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to part two then. Let's welcome Chloe Beresford to talk about the situation at AC Milan, who have sacked their manager Vincenzo Montella and brought in Gennaro Gattuso.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we're now joined by Chloe Beresford, the Serie A correspondent for The Sportsman. Chloe, welcome to the front three.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. We're here, of course, to talk about AC Milan, Chloe. They've sacked Vincenzo Montella and appointed club legend Gennaro Gattuso as his successor. Let's talk Montella first. He impressed last season, of course, but this season his Milan side have been a real disappointment, with this weekend's 0-0 draw with Genoa proving to be the final straw after a string of disappointing results, Chloe.
Yeah, it's actually the fourth nil when they haven't scored at San Siro in terms of league games. So I think the fans there have really voiced their frustration at not scoring. And I think, you know, you can sometimes tell with managers when they do their post-match interviews, when they're sort of, when they're done really, and when they can't, they're not going to be able to turn things around. And the things he was sort of saying, you know, every week, he was like, well, you know, we played well and you know, we were improving. And, he just didn't seem to have, he couldn't admit where we're going wrong, and he didn't seem to have any ideas as to how he could pull them out of the mire, really. And it just seemed like, I didn't expect them to do it that soon, but it was definitely coming.
I mean, they pulled the trigger there, as you said, because he didn't seem to have the answers. He simply didn't get the best out of this team this season, a team in which I think over £200 million was invested this summer. Is it fair to say that AC Milan fans are entitled to expect more than an 11th place, as it is now, with over a third of the season gone?
I think entitled is the optimum word there, really, because you can't just throw money at a team and just expect them to win. I mean, obviously AC Milan have such you know, such a great history. Mm. But recently, because things have gone so wrong, you know, it's like building a house on sand. There's no foundations.
Yeah.
And Montella was, you know, he was working well last season on a very tight budget whilst this takeover was going through. And then all of a sudden it's turned on its head in the summer. They've splashed the cash and he's suddenly expected to create a team with all these new players. And, you know, sides that have had great investment in the past, it's taken them a long time to get where they want to be. You can't just throw money at it and expect it to work. It's just not realistic.
Where do you think it went wrong from this season in terms of on the pitch then? I mean, you're talking there about how it's four games without a goal at the San Siro. Is it in a more attacking sense where he sort of failed to find any fluency there? I mean, where did it sort of go wrong for him this season?
I think they've had defensive troubles. They've brought in Bonucci from Juventus, who was obviously a fantastic signing, but he struggled to replicate the form that he showed at Juventus, and there've been a lot of mistakes and bad errors that are so uncharacteristic of him. But also up front, they brought Nikola Kalinic in from Fiorentina, and he's a striker that has proved that he can't score without great service. He's an in the box sort of striker that needs to be laid on a plate, and they've not been really creating that for him. And he's a player that suffers from a lack of confidence. If his head drops, then you know. It's a disaster, really. So, I don't really know why Montella persevered with him, because they've got the youngster Patrick Cutrone, who's been very good for them, and he scored 3 goals in 3 starts, whereas Kalinic only had 1 in 11. So, you know, it's perhaps a little bit of a selection issue. But he was, you know, Montella was trying all different formations, different personnel, and you know, it wasn't settled, and that was a complete difference to last season. And you know, there was just so much pressure and expectation on him.
Do you think he should have been given more time then? Has he been hard done by here, Montella, given now we know his successor? Should he be given more of a chance by the club's hierarchy to turn things around? Or was it time to pull the trigger?
It's hard to say, because the problems at Milan are so complex that Montella was just a symptom of a general problem. So in some ways I think he needed to be sacked, but in other ways I think the club have been unfair on him, in the sense that he was brought in and promised money, and the takeover took so much longer with all these delays than was expected. So he had to manage with what he had, and he did a good job with what he had last season. And then this season they've suddenly invested and he's expected to produce miracles. And you know, their business plan is highly unusual in the fact that these Chinese owners have come in and they have based their business plan on results on the pitch. They want to get into the Champions League. And that then will finance the money that's been spent, and they've had to acquire money from a hedge fund, and they're very aggressive in getting their repayments back. And it's all so deep rooted that you can't lay all the blame at Montella's door. It's just a mess.
Oh yeah, there's clearly issues higher up at the club. I think I saw Gabriel Marcotti, who's obviously the ESPN and the Times journalist, talking earlier this week about how the club could be changing hands next season. There seems to be a lot of uncertainty around those owners with, as you say, this highly unusual business plan. You said, there seems to be a lot riding on qualification for the Champions League this season, obviously the monetary rewards that come with it. Do Milan now, with Gattuso coming in, really have a realistic chance of finishing their top four, though? And if not, do you think Gattuso could switch focus to try to win the Europa League? Is that the most realistic route of getting back into the elite competition in Europe?
Yeah, I really can't see them qualifying for the Champions League through the league. You know, obviously, you've got Juventus, Napoli, Roma, who are very strong. And this year, Inter have really, really improved under Luciano Spalletti. And then you've got Lazio and Sampdoria knocking on the door as well. And I think all of those sides are head and shoulders above Milan at the moment. And I don't think it's something that can be turned around by just just bringing in somebody else. You know, he may be a club legend, but he's not really got the experience managerially. I just don't see it. In terms of the Europa League, they have been doing better in that competition than in the league, and you know, maybe that is a more realistic chance. But you know, equally, once teams start dropping into the competition from the Champions League, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough whichever way you look at it, really.
What has been the reaction generally to Gattuso's appointment? Because obviously there's no lack of passion with Gennaro Gattuso, but surely he's a questionable appointment given his managerial record. I believe he's lost more games than he's won at three of the four sides he's managed so far in his managerial career. He's going to have his work out to prove he's the man for the job, isn't he?
Yeah, I would think so. I saw a stat earlier on to say that although Milan have had their problems with not scoring, he had 11 nil-nil draws at Pisa during 2016-17. So,
wow.
You know, I saw that and I thought, right, okay. I don't think, you know, he's obviously not that well qualified. He's got the passion and the heart. You know, he might be able to improve the fortunes, but I don't think he's a long-term appointment at all. I think they'll look to bring somebody in, but you know, at the end of the season maybe, but you know, who even knows who their owners are going to be by next season. It's all up in the air. He might be able to improve things in the short term, but I doubt it.
Yeah, it is. There are doubts over that. I mean, unless he can succeed expectations, as you say, it will be a short-term appointment. As you mentioned, there's so much uncertainty around the ownership. We don't know who's going to own the club next season, whether it's going to change hands, if it's going to be flipped, etc. But there is this sense that, you know, Milan haven't had an elite manager since Max Allegri left in 2014. And that does seem to be what they're missing. And there are potential options out there. I mean, I can't help but think Antonio Conte would be a great appointment. He's cast doubt on his future at Chelsea, says that he'll be returning to Italy in the not-too-distant future. Even Carlo Ancelotti, who's out of a job at the moment, could they potentially reappoint him at AC Milan? Do you think these options are realistic?
Yeah, I think depending on the finances and if the club can prove that they're going to be stable, that somebody like Conte could be a realistic choice. I mean, he's spoken quite a few times about being homesick, and I think a return to Italy is realistic for him. Again, I don't know about Ancelotti, because it depends on whether he'd be willing to go back there with the club in the state that it is, because you know, I guess he's got a reputation and he doesn't want to tarnish that. And it also has been linked with the vacant Italy job. So I'm not so sure about Ancelotti, but yeah, Conte could be a realistic choice.
Could be interesting then. AC Milan's are going to be putting their hopes on that one. Conte returning to Italy and come back to Milan. We'll see what happens. But Chloe, for now, thank you so much for joining us on the Front Three. Where can the listeners find more of you?
You can find me on Twitter at Chloe J Beresford, and I also have a Facebook page. You can just search Chloe Beresford on there and you'll find me.
Right, we're back for part three. Thanks for Chloe for coming on the Front Three. Some very interesting thoughts there on the situation at AC Milan. Gattuso, Chris, is going to save Milan.
He'll give them a good kick up the backside no matter what. I mean, that was... There's the press conference from his time, I think it was at OFI Crete or somewhere like that, in the Cypriot League, where he does just go nuts in a press conference. And the beauty of it is, obviously, the journalists don't speak English and vice versa. He doesn't speak Cypriot or whatever the language is there. Apologies for not knowing. And so it's all done through a translator. And even his English isn't the greatest, to be fair, I'm good to. So it's good, but it's not perfect. But it's all very hilarious to watch. He was at Pisa as well for a while, and they had a bizarre record under him. They pretty much didn't score but didn't concede either. And I think, look, he loves the club, definitely. I thought you were going to say two dead frogs in a conga. He clearly loves the club. The thing with this is, and I'm, it just, to me, it points to the fact that this club is a mess at the minute. And let's be fair, the warning signs were there from the second that the owner couldn't get the funding very easily. yes, you can spend money, buy Silva, you can buy Kessié and all this, and there was a lot of positive feelings around Milan in the summer. But at the same time, you look at, say, Inter, who were laughed at during the summer for some of their business, and they look on a much better footing to me. Because I think they've got a plan, first and foremost. You know, they've got someone in Spalletti that knows what he's doing, that has worked in this kind of environment before. And it's planned and it's meticulous. And I think that's when you should always worry as a football fan, when it doesn't feel like your club has a plan. And I think that's why I look at someone like Newcastle, and I'm not hugely worried, because I feel like Benitez does have a plan. He's planned for all of this. And so it's what Milan need more than anything. They don't need more big signings. They need someone with a vision that extends past next week and next month.
Conte.
Oh, yeah. That'd be a great appointment. What else do we have this weekend? We saw Barcelona got a late point against Valencia, 1-1 in the end. Probably should have won it. The ghost goal. It was another famous ghost goal. Lionel Messi pretty much scoring in the 30th minute, but ruled out. La Liga is the only Big Five European league to not have goal line technology. So I think after that we'll probably see that brought in next season. Did you guys talk about Lionel Messi signing his new contract on Thursday's podcast? Was that after? Did that happen after?
Ooh, it was after.
Yes. Well, he's signed a new contract until 2021. I believe he's got something like a 600 million buyout clause. I think it's 626 million buyout clause.
Does it come with an accountant as well?
Yeah, it probably should. Yeah, funnily enough, all these Barcelona players get into tax issues. What do you make of this notice? Because I was a little bit surprised by this. I was starting to think that, you know, as good as Barcelona are doing domestic this season, they are top of the league. They're 4 points clear of Valencia after that result of the weekend. I was just feeling like long term, maybe it was time for Messi to move on. I was thinking maybe there's something to this reunion potential with Guardiola at Manchester City, prove himself in the Premier League. Looks like he's now going to be spending the rest of his career, the remaining years of his career at Barcelona. Do you think that's the right decision for him?
As far as we know, I mean, he could. Messi's still such a powerful player that if he wanted to leave, he could just say he wanted to leave. You know, there's nothing really. A buyout clause basically is, first of all, I think it's mandatory in certain countries. And then you also have to acknowledge that I think it's, you know, you don't necessarily have to meet that. That can just be more of a guideline. The player can still leave even if the club don't pay that. So there's a lot more there. I think the ultimate aim is to be a one club man and to, you know, be part of that culture in the long term. I'd be interested to see. Part of me feels like Messi's obviously a great player, but I'm not sure if how much of what he wants to achieve is image, and how much of what he has achieved is going to be achievable in post, sort of in management speak as well. Because I don't know if Messi's the most inspirational figure, is what I'm saying.
I see what you're saying.
Do you know what I mean?
He's definitely a very insular seeming person. He's not the most outspoken. There's no idea that Ken Early brought up on the Second Captains podcast, another great podcast last week. Basically, that maybe Messi should leave Barcelona. Obviously, that hasn't happened, but he's level on. They almost don't matter anymore because they've become this best thing. I was going to say he's level on Ballon d'Ors with Cristiano Ronaldo, which is a travesty, I would suggest. Obviously he wants to win more Champions League titles, he wants to win more league titles, but I think the European Cup, the Champions League is the premier honour that players want to win. Is that really likely with Barcelona, is what I'm thinking. Certainly not this year. I don't think they're anywhere near the favourites for this competition. But given their transfer strategy and the way the club's been running in recent years, I'm not sure that's a realistic prospect in the seasons to come. Whereas when you look at Manchester City, they've probably got one of, if not the best squads in the world, one of the most promising squads as well. How talented the young players are. They were seeing how much Raheem Sterling's improved under Pep Guardiola. Kevin De Bruyne, he's probably the best player in the league right now. Leroy Sané as well. I felt like if Messi moved to a club like that, he'd have more chances to win more Champions League titles and ultimately more Ballon d'Ors, which I think is something that, you know, we give Cristiano Ronaldo criticism for focusing on those individual ones, but I think it is something that Messi cares about as well and wants to win more of those to define his career and define his legacy.
Mm.
Just not sure if Barcelona is going to be the place for him to do that in the final few years of his career. I think next January, unless, you know, Messi or Ronaldo inspires their respective teams to World Cup glory, I think it will be the first time we don't see Messi or Ronaldo win the Ballon d'Or since, what, 2007, is it? 2008? It might be someone like Kevin De Bruyne, etc. So I'm not 100% sure it is the right move for him, although there is that, I like that emotional reason for staying at Barcelona, for being that one club man. You know, he could still, is it Newell's Old Boys he still could go back to in Argentina to finish out his career? That's something he said he wanted to do. But we'll see. We should talk as well this weekend about how Borussia Dortmund somehow capitulated, throwing away a 4-goal lead at Schalke, Chris. They were 4-0 up at half-time. It was 4-2 when Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang got sent off, and they managed to completely fall apart. 4-0 finished in the end. There was talk in the week about how Peter Bosz had two games to save his job. Those two games didn't exactly go too well for him. The first Dortmund lost 2-1 to Spurs in the Champions League midweek. Now this result, I mean, is it time up for Peter Bosz now?
Yeah, I think so. It's a bizarre one with him. It's, I mean, a lot of his decisions don't make sense. I thought he was a very good coach at Ajax. I just wonder sometimes, you look at the those disciples of Cruyff, if you will, Coleman, people like that. I just wonder how adaptable the Cruyff principles are to situations. I wonder if, you know, it fits a league like the Eredivisie, but when it comes to the Bundesliga, you need to be a bit more pragmatic. You need to be a bit more maybe resolute in situations. And I think certainly he's taken some of those principles on. And you could argue some of the principles are easier to implement than others, you know, the short interchanges, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I definitely wouldn't be surprised if you told me tomorrow that he had been sacked, because I just think it's not been a good fit or a good start for him. And I think it's one thing to draw the derby at home. It's an entirely different thing when you're 4-0 up at half time. That is just a collapse of epic proportions.
Imagine conceding more than 3 goals.
Yeah, they've stolen Liverpool's thunder in many ways. But it looks like it could.
Bloody Liverpool aren't the shittest team in Europe.
Speaking of Liverpool, though, I mean, it looks like it could be time up for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Well, this is good news for you, Lawrence. I mean, there's
no,
these
it
reports.
Isn't. No one wants Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. No.
Would you not like to see him? And then Peter Bosz came out after the game and blamed Aubameyang basically for that. That sort of defeat, saying his
Aubameyang has been public enemy number one in Dortmund for a while, because he seemed to have changed his demeanour. He's dressing more bling bling, as
that's
they
the
said
main issue.
On the continent. I think it was James Horncastle who said this on the continent. He said it was part of the image change for him, that he had high aspirations, that he'd been shopping himself around, and he was saying, you know, someone in China's big money for me. And then they said, "Well, go then." And he went, "Well,
he's disappeared up his own.
You guys would.
Rear end, is that what it is?
He's disappeared up his own bam, if you will."
Yes, but you wouldn't like to see him at Liverpool. It looks like Dortmund could sell him in January. You know, someone's going to come in for him. Could be like a cut price deal almost. I mean, despite those sort of off the pitch ego
still,
issues.
Yeah, but still, a cut price deal is what, 30 million, 40 million. Maybe?
For Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, you're not tempted by that if you're Jurgen Klopp?
I see someone who doesn't fix the problems that Liverpool have is the problem.
Yes.
And that, I mean, as much as it's nice, you know, it's obviously lovely when you think, wow, we're going to get a great player. But, you know, you think of previous maybe strikers who didn't quite fit what Liverpool needed at the time that have been there, Fernando Morientes, you know, Robbie Fowler signing for Liverpool. I'm trying to think of other strikers now that have been bad at Liverpool.
I'm just saying, ship out Sturridge, ship him out to West Ham in January, bring Aubameyang in. It's not a bad little...
Well, apparently Sturridge won't be allowed to leave because Liverpool don't want to spend in that area yet, anyway. But he's worried that he won't get enough game time to get on the plane to Brazil, to Russia. So we'll see. We'll see. See if he gets his wish.
Let's finish up by giving some kudos to the son of Patrick Kluivert, Chris. Justin Kluivert scored a hat-trick this weekend in a 5-1 win over Roda JC for Ajax. The clip's doing the rounds, of course, because it's a fantastic hat-trick for him. Turns out he's quite good at football, this guy. He's got the genes.
your own shorts.
Yes, it was actually a really good hat-trick as well. His touch, he is a very different player to his dad. It's important to note that he's a winger first and foremost, and he's quite a good dribbler, quite quick, quite good with the tricks and all of that stuff that the kids enjoy. But yeah, he's part of quite a good generation. Yeah, well, that's
K2. It's good.
K2, but he's part of a very good generation at Ajax at the minute. You've got the likes of Onana, De Ligt, Donny van der Beek. I'm trying to think who's the other one. Frankie de Jong. That's who I'm thinking of. That are coming through at the same time. And, I mean, it hasn't really been the greatest transition for Ajax from Peter Bos to the new coach. But if there is a glimmer of light, it's people like Kluivert, because it's, like I say, if you haven't seen it, go and watch his hat-trick, because it's a really good piece of wing play for each goal.
Well, that brings an end to this week's Front Three Weekend Review podcast, guys. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back on Thursday with a wrap-up of all the midweek Premier League action, as well as a Q&A, as always. Until then, Chris, where can people find you? Is there any work you want to plug? Any writing?
Yes, medium.com. I do a couple of thoughts from the weekend's Premier League action. Something new I've tried.
Yeah, I did read last week's one. I enjoyed that very much, so I look forward to reading this week's one. Lawrence, where can people find you?
Great question. Just go to the Front Three Twitter. Be lovely. At the Front Three, the numeral three, of
course. Yeah, guys, do go and follow that.
Magnanimous in defeat.
You can follow me at Adam Boltwood on Twitter. Until Thursday, have a bloody great week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.